Too many Americans think they're prepared for retirement, until healthcare costs and income gaps quietly derail everything they have planned. Let's get into it.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals.
And I'm your host, David Saltzman. To help us understand all of this, we've invited Chris Orestes, president of Retirement Genius and a nationally recognized expert on retirement income planning and long-term care strategies, among other things. Chris has spent decades helping individuals and advisors navigate the financial realities that can make or break a successful retirement. Welcome, Chris. Thanks for being on the program.
Oh, it's great to be here, and it's great to be talking to all our friends at NABIP.
Let's start with the big picture. What's the biggest disconnect between what people think retirement will cost and what it actually costs?
Well, you know, the disconnect starts in a couple of places. One, there's a huge lack of financial literacy overall, but in particular, when it comes to understanding the unique financial challenges of aging and declining health. So on the one hand, It's informationally, there's just a huge lack of information, which is ironic because there's so much information that's out there. Secondly, it's also a topic that people just don't want to talk about. It's a topic people don't want to discuss. It's the one topic around the Thanksgiving table no one wants to have a discussion with their loved ones, the finances and the other realities that come in when somebody is aging, when their health is declining, and it starts to become an imperative that living independently may start to become a challenge, maybe even a threat to their loved one or themselves, future and safety. And so the fact that we have a lack of basis in general knowledge on top of a lack of desire to be thinking or talking about this subject is kind of a noxious brew when you put those two together, that when the time comes, when there's some kind of a health event, too many people find themselves inadequately prepared to take it on, and it's usually then dropped in their lap in the middle of a crisis situation, the clock is ticking, and all of a sudden you go from knowing next to nothing to having to understand how to navigate the American healthcare and long-term care industrial complex almost overnight.
Well, healthcare is one of the biggest wild cards in retirement. Why do so many people underestimate those costs, and where do they typically go wrong?
Well, a big place that they go wrong is everybody operates under the assumption it won't happen to me. And when you look at studies, as much as 85% of people surveyed when asked, are they prepared for a healthcare or long-term care event impacting their retirement? Most say, well, it's not going to happen to me. But interestingly, almost an equal number of people say, but if it does, something takes care of it. It'll be taken care of. It gets paid for. I paid into the system. I have insurance. You know, my loved ones can help around the house, and the reality sets in, and it becomes a real harsh awakening to what you're dealing with, particularly when you've thought the whole time it's not going to happen to me. So you've avoided the planning. And on top of that, that's the individual, the financial advisors. So many financial advisors are running planning scenarios where they're not factoring in the impact of healthcare long-term care costs. You're sort of planning a level playing field all the way through without the impact of all of a sudden a healthcare long-term care event needing the costs associated with to deal with it. And that can undermine somebody's retirement planning in as little time as a year or less.
It's scary. Is retirement more about income than assets? And how should people be thinking differently about those two items?
Well, retirement, number one, I always say retirement, particularly in today's world, like we remember the retirement of our parents, our grandparents, which was that traditional idea of you retire, Maybe you moved to Florida, you're playing golf, you're getting dinner at the buffet at 4:30 p.m. Today, retirement really is about, if you do it right, shifting from doing what you have to do to doing what you want to do. And so often for people in retirement, that includes staying productive, staying engaged, and oftentimes still being able to generate income. Now, income is critical as much as possible. And assets, you got to look at them differently. Like, as income is really your source of cash flow, you know, that's going to take care of your budget. And budgeting is a critical piece of a retirement, and understanding that although your cost of living is going to change in retirement, it's not going away. And you've got to deal with the three components of a well-structured budget. You've got to have your fixed costs, you know, your overhead, your home, your variable costs, things like your bills for utilities. You know, you're going to pay more in the winter for oil than you are in the summer, and you're going to pay more for electricity down south in the summer maybe than you are in the winter, those kinds of variables, and then your discretionary costs. So understanding how your budget can be structured from your income, and then how are you going to draw down on your assets? You know, one of your assets is your home. Are you going to continue living in the home and potentially consider tapping into it at some point in the future to draw down on your equity? Do you have an asset like a life insurance policy? And as you're aging and your health is declining, might you consider tapping into your life insurance policy through something like a life settlement or a policy loan? Do you have an annuity? That's an asset that provides income. So it's the balance of those two things inside a well-formulated budget, and then keeping the ultimate nemesis at bay for retirement. One is the impact of health and long-term care, which we touched on, but the other is debt, and keeping debt at bay. We have more people now in retirement in this country still carrying a mortgage, carrying medical debt, carrying student loans than we ever have had in the history of this country. Typically, people would go into retirement and they would be pretty much debt-free at that point. And so that wasn't eating into their income. That wasn't forcing them to pull down on their assets. The landscape is different now. And debt is an impact. Health and long-term care is an impact on how you're balancing your income and assets.
You know, let's kind of take a little bit of a turn and talk more about long-term care, because that's often avoided. What are people missing when they think about long-term care? And how does that impact the financial stuff that we just talked about?
When you're planning for retirement, and I would say as early as in your 50s, it's important to start thinking about longevity risk. It's a very interesting and, quite frankly, ironic dynamic that all through your life, one of your biggest worries is that you would die too soon. That's why we have life insurance. That's why we do estate planning in case of someone's demise. But you get to a point as you're aging where that dynamic shifts to people start worrying about living too long, that they're going to outlive their income and assets and their ability. I mean, people today, let's say you were to retire at the age of 65, there's a good chance you're still going to be on this planet for another 30 years. You're only a third of the way through. And so how are you going to sustain a quality of living, and put on top of that the impact of the eventuality of long-term care? Now, let's remember, statistically, although most people think it's never going to happen to them, the reality is 70% of people, once they hit the age of 65, are going to need long-term care and some form of long-term care. Now, what is the biggest form of long-term care in this country? Family caregivers. Uncompensated, untrained, and even unaware family caregivers, which becomes a huge drain on the family, on the individuals, on the family. And it's interesting. I've seen this before. where we're talking to a family, trying to evaluate their potential need for care and how is it going to be paid for. So we start examining their activities of daily living. How are they doing on their ability to live independently? And I've heard this answer before, and it's always stuck with me. When we asked somebody, the wife of the gentleman who was considering needing care, how is your husband doing on showering? Does he shower on his own? And her answer was, oh, he showers by himself, no problem. I mean, I help him get in the shower. I don't want him to fall. And then I'll turn on the water because I don't want him to turn it on too hot and then scald himself. And then I'll help him get out again. I don't want him to fall, and I'll give him a towel. So yeah, he showers on his own just fine. People so often don't understand that it not only can happen to them, but that it is happening to them. And it's not just happening to them. It's happening to their loved ones around them. So often, family members become care providers without even realizing that's what they're doing. And that, nobody plans for that. Nobody plans for getting to a point where that's not sufficient anymore. And are you going to need home care? Are you going to go into assisted living, skilled nursing? Is there cognitive issues that might be leading towards memory care? These are all very expensive engagements, that the majority of which is not paid for by Medicare, not paid for by health insurance. Either you have long-term care insurance, you have the income and assets that could be tapped into to pay for what could easily be $10,000 a month cash out of pocket, or you're looking at assets like, am I going to now tap into my home with a reverse mortgage? Am I going to tap into my life insurance policy with a life settlement? Are we going to tap into our annuities and start having that income directed towards care? Or is somebody a veteran? Then could they tap into veterans benefits to help them pay for that? But what happens so often to people is they're trying to figure this out after the horse is out of the barn. Now they're in the care need situation, the costs, the realities are there, and now they're trying to figure it out instead of having put in the time years earlier when it could have been well constructed and organized and the right pieces put in place to take on those expensive costs.
And yet when a lot of advisors talk to folks about LTC, they feel as though they should have brought a defibrillator along with them on the visit, because people look at the costs of the policies and think that they're just unattainable. How do you balance that, the need, the ultimate need that you know is coming, with the cost factor of a good quality long-term care product?
Yeah, that's been what has held back long-term care insurance in this country. So think about this. In a country that has almost 340 million people, there is 7.5 million enforced long-term care insurance policies today. That's it. And I say to groups we work with many of the big home care assisted living companies around the United States, helping them with families to cover their costs of care. And I'll tell their outlets, if a family walks in the door with a long-term care insurance policy ready to go and go on claim and start paying, that is a unicorn event. You're not going to see that on a daily, weekly, maybe even monthly basis. Certainly, it's a viable way to pay for care, but not enough people have procured long-term care insurance policies because it requires foresight and taking on that dynamic we started at the top with, thinking about something you don't want to think about. That eventually you may need this. And what is insurance at the end of the day? It's an instrument to hedge risk that may or may not occur in the future. So long-term care insurance, just like life insurance, just like health insurance, when purchased, the younger and healthier you are, the lower the cost it would be. But by definition, that means it's the longer period you're going to carry it, keeping it in force. Now, a big area of growth for long-term care insurance in this country has been through as a group benefit. People buying it through an employer, through an association, through an affinity group, where they can get it at a group underwritten rate, which will ring familiar to many members of NABIP. Group underwritten group benefits Which, by the way, for those that are NABIT members that work with group benefits, adding a long-term care insurance benefit to the tray of available benefits is an excellent maneuver. People want it and value it more now than ever, and it is the cheapest entry point anybody will ever have to get long-term care insurance in life. So if you're an employee or a member of an organization that will allow you to access a long-term care insurance policy as a group benefit, run, do not walk to accepting that coverage. Because once that's in place, you can port it, you can carry it with you for the rest of your life, and that will be the cheapest opportunity you'll ever find to get your hands on long-term care insurance. There are other ways to get long-term care insurance as standalone plans or as hybrid plans where they're a combination of life insurance and long-term care insurance coverage. There's also annuities that have long-term care insurance riders, long-term care insurance benefits built into them. And then there's also the use of existing life insurance policies that somebody owns that as they're aging and their health is declining, they can liquidate through the life settlement market and then get that lump sum payment that they can turn around under tax advantaged scenarios based on their health to use for long-term care. So there are a number of vehicles to get there, but it all starts with understanding that those vehicles exist. And again, starting where this discussion began, so many people don't want to think about this.
Is it also for advisors to understand that these are emotional decisions for the most part, rather than educated long-term planning components? In other words, if I'm an agent, how do I go to somebody and understand walking in the door that this is going to be an emotional conversation and I have to help them get past that or use that to understand what might be coming in the future and to take action today?
Yeah, it is a very emotional discussion. Part of the reason why people don't want to talk about this, but in a planning scenario with a professional and advisor who either has the ability to convey that kind of coverage or has a partnership with a group that they can work with to help convey that kind of coverage, it is an emotional discussion. But it's interesting that people, particularly as they're getting older and their health is starting to get rockier, there's a level of acceptance and practicality that starts to come in and lower the emotional emotions of it. I would say, if at all possible, involving family members in the discussion versus it being in a black box, and then you're going back and trying to explain to family members, and then they're starting to, you know, then you're getting the peanut gallery effect of, you don't need that. I've heard that coverage is a ripoff. I heard it's too expensive. If you involve the family, because long-term care is so often a family journey, it's not something that a person does by themselves. Usually it involves family members who there may be multiple family members who play multiple roles in that journey, where their buy-in to the process and understanding where this is going and how these kind of solutions and vehicles can help not only solve the problem for their loved one, but also for themselves. Let's not forget, for so many family members, they get dragged into become care providers or financiers of the care. Before you know it, the adult children are cutting checks and passing the hat around for how are we covering the deficit to make up the money we need for $10,000 a month. And it starts to become something the family members are paying into. But if any of the variety of ways to cover it that we've discussed are in place, not only does that take care of the loved one, but it is protection for the family members. And oftentimes, I have talked to advisors who have emphasized that to their loved one, to the person who needs care, more than the care they need themselves. This isn't about getting a policy in place to take care of you. This is about getting a policy in place to protect your family. from the physical, emotional, and financial impact that's going to come from the fact that this happened to you and you did not have the means, you were not prepared to cover it, and it all of a sudden became the entire family's problem.
Yeah, it's an awful lot like a lot of kinds of insurance, isn't it? I mean, years ago, I was helping a bunch of P&C brokers try to learn how to sell life insurance. And one of them said to me, well, most of my clients are my age and I'm 30. You know, they keep telling me, well, I'm not going to die today or tomorrow, so I don't need life insurance. What do I tell them? And the answer is, you're not buying life insurance because you're going to die. You're buying life insurance because your family is going to live after you die. And that's why, I mean, I remember in the very first iteration of long-term care, when we first started talking about it all those years ago, there were a lot of children, adult children, buying policies for their parents. Is that still happening?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think we're seeing situations where the children would be better off to pool their money to cover that premium if their loved one will still qualify. Remember, you get past the age of 60, the window where most long-term care insurance is purchased is 50 to 60. Now, you get to 60 plus, and you can still get into long-term care insurance coverage, but I'd say by the time you get to 70, the door is pretty much closed, other than shifting to different things like short-term care insurance. There's short-term care insurance. There's other ways to address coverage, like True Freedom plans, reverse mortgages, life insurance settlements, VA benefits for people that are older, sicker, and now they're at the point they need the care. But if you're going to get coverage in place, typically it's going to be between the age of 50 and 60. And if your kids are in a position to contribute to the cost of that, they're better off to do that now than to be chipping in to cover the cost of care later. Somebody once said to me, and it was a point very well made, if you can't afford the premium, you can't afford the coverage later. So you better figure out how to try and make that work, because if you can't make this work, you are a sitting duck later, other than going on to Medicaid. But then you have to take on a Medicaid spend down. You've got to put yourself down to the poverty level. You've got to strip yourself of assets and income. And then you're not able to pick where and what kind of care you're going to get. If you're on Medicaid, you don't get to say, okay, well, now I'm ready to move into that beautiful assisted living community where they're having barbecues and steak dinners and driving to the mall, or I want to stay at home and age in place. No, you're on Medicaid. You're a ward of the state now, and you're going into a nursing home where you're going to share a bedroom with one or two other people, and it's a completely different ballgame than if you're private pay. Private pay maintains control, maintains choice, maintains dignity. But private pay is private pay. You're paying that out of your pocket, out of your resources, out of insurance, out of whatever it is you've been able to put together.
So to wrap up this segment, would you say that the biggest mistake is inaction?
Yes. The biggest mistake is inaction, driven by a lack of awareness and a lack of desire to even want to think or talk about this. But at some point, When the bell rings and it's your turn, your loved one is in a hospital bed, they've been there for a day or two, and they're getting ready to discharge to a rehab facility, and then the discharge nurse, the social care workers are looking at you saying, okay, what do you have in place? We're moving to this facility. You've got Medicare coverage for a short window. What do you have in place going forward from there? Do you have Medicaid? Do you have long-term care insurance? Do you have all these areas that we've covered? And so many families all of a sudden start looking around the room at each other like, I don't know. We don't even know. Where are the files? Where's mom or dad's stuff back at her home? We better look for this stuff. And it's just an absolute crisis-driven circular firing drill at that point that you will not be getting the type of result you want and your loved one deserves.
Let's pull the lens back a little bit and talk a little bit more broadly. What should people be doing earlier in their career so that they avoid major financial stress later?
Three key things you want to do early in your career. One, take full advantage of tax-deferred vehicles such as IRAs, 401ks, health savings accounts, wherever you can put money away that is pre-tax and grows tax-deferred. You want to get the maximum benefit out of that. Somebody who starts putting money in a 401k account with their first job in their 20s could be a millionaire by the time they're in their 40s. But if you wait till your 40s, you will not be a millionaire by the time you get to your 60s. It's not going to work that way. You want to avoid debt. Be smart about your budget. Do all you can to keep debt at a minimum. And then thirdly, maybe one of the most important financial investments anybody will ever make is in their health. Staying fit, staying healthy, trying to avoid the need for care later down the road that is so expensive and will undermine your retirement. And I always said, what good is a Ferrari sitting in your garage if you're too sick to drive it?
Good point. Last question. If someone was listening, who's listening or was talking to one of our NABIP brethren or sisters and listening to a discussion about this, what's the one smart move that they could make today to improve their retirement and healthcare outcome?
Well, for themselves as individuals, take advantage of at whatever age you're at, do you have the right tools in place? Can you get long-term care insurance? Could you set up an annuity with a long-term care rider? Could you get a life insurance policy that's a hybrid to long-term care? Or do you have life insurance? Hang on to it, because that could be something later down the road you could cash in and use for long-term care through a life settlement. That's for you personally, but for them as practitioners, and how can they help their clients to do those things? It's to get out of siloed thinking. If you're an agent, if you're an advisor, and you specialize in something, you're a specialist in selling Medicare or ACA or group benefits. Don't just keep your head buried in the one track that you focus on, because you can expand the tools in your toolbox to help people better be prepared for the realities of aging and the financial impact that's going to happen to them in retirement and potentially declining health in their later years. Whether it's your ability to offer alternative types of services or partnering with other groups that do. There's plenty of opportunities for a Medicare agent to partner with specialists in annuity, in long-term care insurance, in life insurance, in reverse mortgages, in a whole range of things that can give them a well-rounded toolbox and put them in the position where they're not just a salesperson selling their thing. They're a real solution provider. They're a real trusted expert. That's going to get more business opportunities for them in their practice, and it'll expand the reach from their one client across that person's sphere of influence, family, friends. When you've got an advisor that has a well put together team of solutions and a toolbox full of tools to meet the needs of the client versus I sell you the one thing and then best of luck to you.
You know, earlier in his career, I'm going to tell on you, Chris, earlier in his career, he spent a lot of time and has a lot of background in Washington as a policy insider. And so we're going to break here, and then we're going to come back in our next episode of Healthcare Happy Hour and pick Chris's brain about some things political. Chris, thanks for a great part one. We'll see you in part two.
Sounds good.
you can have the Healthcare Happy Hour podcast downloaded automatically by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also find a link to the podcast in the member-exclusive Washington Update, published on Fridays. For more information on our government affairs efforts or to become a member, visit nabip.org.